You're now tuned in to the Views of Voices podcast. I'm your host, Dwan Thompson. We have a special guest, my brother Kay Bell, man. But go ahead and introduce yourself. Basically, tell me what you got going on with your path right now, your life path.
Already, man. Already. Now, I appreciate the introduction, man. Like D said, me and him go way back, man. They call me Kay Bell, but my name is Kevin Bell. I am a 3-year veteran of the department here in San Antonio, man. I do a lot of community outreach, specifically patrol the east side. Throughout the days and nuances of the job and whatnot, I try to get involved in the school systems as well. It's very important. I think that especially, in our profession and within our culture, the Black culture, I think it's important that we have that liaison between community and policing, something that really isn't taught in the school systems. And it's something that I try to do outside of the job, you know, and I think that's very important, especially for young kids coming up.
Most definitely. And so would you say that drives you to be an officer today?
Man, to be honest with you, bro, like coming up, like I never was that kid coming up like, hey, man, I want to be an officer. I want to be a police officer.
Yeah.
You know, I see him on the street and wave at him. You know, I always saw somebody in a law enforcement capacity or in a uniform as a negative stereotype towards myself. I always, always thought that, man. I never saw him in the light. And it took me, and I tell this story all the time, when I was a little boy, I never really got allowance like that. So, yeah. You know, my parents were like, hey, go out and cut yards. And the first yard, the first guy that I knocked on his door, I was just like, hey, man, do you mind if I cut your yard? You know, I'm just a young kid just trying to make some money. Had my lawnmower, had my edger, had my gas sitting on top of my lawnmower, you know, just kind of old school.
Had every day.
Yeah. So I knocked on his door. He opened it. He said, hey, man, what's going on, little bro? And he had his Dallas County Sheriff's Officer uniform. And I was just like, wow, man, that's cool. He talked like me. You know, he looked like me. Every single time I cut his yard, he would, you know, treat me like his own family, you know, never skipped a beat. And he was just him in and out of the uniform. And, you know, for me, I thought that was so important because I really never saw that, you know. And so I think just seeing that and just coming, you know, going into middle school, going into high school, you know, I never had that idea until I got, you know, further on in college. And it was just like it clicked.
Okay. See, that's what's up, man. And so, you know, being a police officer right now in today's world, it's so controversial, right?
Yeah.
So what made you, besides that story right there, because I know you were doing criminal justice in college, yeah. What made you become a police officer? Like, what drove you down that route within the criminal justice system?
Yeah. So, man, it's kind of an add-on answer to the previous question that you asked. Okay. I don't know if you remember, DJ, we were about to go through fall camp. Right. 2 days. Mm-hmm. It was about to start a week before 2 days. And we were all sitting inside of the, you know, that media room. I guess we were watching film or whatever. And we had a guy and it just a guest speaker come in.
Mm.
And he was an ex-convict, I think, of like 15 years.
Yeah, I remember.
And so, he came in. And when he came in, man, he gave his little spiel. I think it was about 15 to 20 minutes of him speaking. And he actually said, in the message, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And you know, DJ, man, you hear that all the time, like, you know, from your moms, from your kinfolk, everybody tells you that, where do you see yourself? And it just goes in one ear and out the other sometimes. But for me, I think at that point, you know, dealing with what I was going through at the time and just trying to figure out, you know, what was the best possible scenario for me. When he said that, I was just like, I went in kind of like just tunnel vision, you know, like what do I really see myself doing? You know, I know I'm not as business savvy as you know, some other people may be. I know I'm not in the entrepreneurial ship field. I know I'm not, you know, in the medical field or in that type of capacity. And I started putting together that I love serving people and I love helping people out. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, just with my upbringing and to where, you know, where I was at that point in time, I just tried to correlate the two together. And it was just kind of like a refresher for me, that foundation for me. It was just like, if not me, then who? You know, and I think that it starts, you know, with with us uplifting our own, you know what I'm saying? And trying, and not just black youth, but everybody, no matter what color, no matter what ethnicity, no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, just trying to be the best version of yourself so other people can see it and be like, you know, wow, like I can actually be something, whether it's in law enforcement, whether it's in the medical field, whether you're in public speaking or you're giving some sort of professional outlook on life, be the best at it and mm-hmm. try to, you know, emphasize and just put on that platform that person, just bring out the best in themselves. Because when they see you, they see a vision. They see mm-hmm. the manifestation of their dreams. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that's important growing up.
See, I think that answer is really amazing because it's being part of the solution. Like one quote that I saw on YouTube, a dude said, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, be part of the solution. And so mm-hmm. basically I feel like your field is definitely being part of the solution of helping people, serving people that need to be served. Like you said, it doesn't even matter about the color. Just you need to help people that need to be helped. I know right now you're doing patrol, right? On the streets?
Yeah. I'm a patrol man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I was about to say right now I'm on patrol. Like I told you earlier, my work hours are from, you know, 5 in the evening to 3 in the morning, you know, four days on, 3 days off. So we're in that high capacity time zone where, you know, stuff pops off. You know, every single hour, you know, something's going on, whether you have to assist somebody with a family violence issue or a simple disturbance or walking a lady across the street to any type of high priority call, whether it's an accident major or shooting or cutting, anything like that, we have to respond to it. Mm-hmm. And so, just like you stated, man, it's all about your approach and how you kind of assess that situation.
Yeah. And so with doing patrol, do you plan on being on the streets for the rest of your career, or where do you plan on venturing off within the department?
Yeah, man. You know, with departments, and as you know, man, departments are so big and broad where you can do a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. With me personally, you know, I like the position that I'm in, but I'm not stagnant myself. I take that community approach. Of course, you know, I want to, you know, go ahead and level up as I, you know, become more studious as the years progress on and so on and so forth, you know, going up to that detective level or going, you know, to sergeant, that's where I envision myself eventually going. However, God, you know, has another opportunity or another avenue for me to go, whether it's the federal level or whether it's just venturing off into, you know, nonprofit organizations, trying to bridge that gap between community leaders and police itself. I think that's really that commonality ground, because that really helps out not only community relations, it helps out the understanding of both sides. And right now it's just, I feel as if that it's not a one-edged sword. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't fight fire with fire. You can't sit here and point the finger and point the blame, and you have to, you know, find that commonality, because we all live in this world together, man.
We do.
And it's sad to see, you know, some of the stuff take place, and it's sad to see, you know, where people's minds are, you know, mm-hmm. and it's you find out true colors, you find out, you know, how people may feel about something or what they may say that triggers your thought and your upbringing, and you try to educate them. And sometimes, you know, that education may come off as being abrasive towards them.
Yeah.
Definitely. It might come off as, you know, you weren't taught what I was taught. I'm not going to have an open ear to what you're saying, so I'm not going to listen to you. Mm-hmm. Rather than just saying, hey, you know, I hear what you're saying. Okay, let's find a common solution. Yeah. Instead of already coming up to the assumption of, I'm listening to you, I hear you, but I'm just still going to believe what I want to believe. You're not growing. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I think that's very important for, you know, law enforcement and the community, is understanding people's path and their journey, because mm-hmm. not everybody is the same. Right. But at the end of the day, we're all humans and we're all one. Right. And in order to get to that level of us being together, we need to understand where people come from, understand how people are raised, understand the trials and tribulations that people go through. And yeah. I think in today's world, we don't really do that, right? We just look at something as it is in front of us instead of trying to understand what people have been through. And so I definitely think that this path in law enforcement would definitely, it's definitely helping in your position, it's definitely helping to get both sides of the story, which I think is so huge. And I know you said that, you know, not everybody, black, white, Mexican, it doesn't matter. But I think black law enforcement, I think there needs to be more of us because we only listen to each other sometimes, man. We can relate. And I think that's huge.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail right on the head, man. You know, when I go into, and I work the east side on San Antonio, man. So the east side is predominantly African-American. So when I go to calls and when I speak to people and when I'm talking to people, it's not only benefiting me, but it's also benefiting them in a sense of where when I go on the scene, I'm not taking that aggression in tone as a form of hostility towards me, you know, because I understand and I kind of get the frustration. However, my ability to speak and kind of de-escalate that situation before it can grow to a magnitude of any type of hand-to-hand combat or any type of, you know, I got to go hands-on with this guy or going any type of secondary weapon of any sort, just simply having that conversation and looking at that person as if, you know, they were my cousin, they were my mom, they were my dad, they were, you know, a sister, a brother to me, one of my homeboys outside of the uniform. So I think that helps me out a lot to interact and be more personal. I told somebody in the past, you know, the more personal you can get with the people that you serve, especially, you know, within the black community, the more trust that you'll gain. It's not about, you know, the high priority calls when you go there, how you react towards them and how they react towards you. It's those days where you don't have nothing going on and you drive by the neighborhood and you see a kid outside playing basketball. And you step outside of the car and you shoot basketball with them. Or you see some kids playing, you know, throw up tackle and you get the football and you start throwing the ball and you start making games with them. They'll remember that, you know, they'll remember that picture. They'll remember your face. And so the next time that they have that encounter with the law enforcement officer within their neighborhood, they're like, oh, man, I knew Officer Bell, man. It was cool, man. Cool. Like he treated me, you know, with respect and stuff like that. Like, I appreciate that. I'm going to tell another officer when, you know, I see him on my street. You know, play a little game of whatever the case may be, basketball, run track or football or soccer or baseball. But it's the time when it's least expected that the appreciation grows even more, because it's so easy to show appreciation. It's so easy to show respect when stuff happens.
Yeah.
You know, when I show up on scene and I'm trying to consult the mother of a victim who was just, you know, brutally wounded or injured or possibly killed in an auto accident or shooting. But what about those instances where I roll up on a family reunion or a barbecue that's outside on the front porch and I'm talking to a family, you know, just interacting with them. This just that civil encounter, that consensual encounter. I think that's important because that takes you outside of that uniform, that badge, and it puts you actually in their shoes, man.
It does. It really does. And I think now today, I know it used to be more of a reaction, like law enforcement used to be more of a reaction. Now it's just going there, just trying to put your face out there, trying to, you know, make a name for as a law enforcement officer into like a positive light into the community. So but let's talk about patrols, man. And being a police officer, it's a dangerous job, right? And I want to know, how do you ever think about the what ifs, like what could happen while you're doing patrol? And, you know, if you do think about that, how do you cope with that?
Yeah, man. That's a real good and solid question, too, D. I would say for me, what I do, man, every day, man, I just give God thanks and give him the praise, man, for just allowing me just to do what I'm doing, just to be here on this earth, another 24 to make things right and do better than I was the previous day before. But my number one thing is faith, bro. You got to have that faith. Yes, and that's whatever you do. that's even outside of law enforcement. You have to have that faith because, you know, there might be a day where I have a horrible day, where I misjudge something, or I, you know, I don't log in something correctly, or I don't write that report in which, you know, it might turn into something. And this is just the hypothetical, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
You know, if I'm always worrying about something, then I'm not having that faith in it. And I think that faith really carries you on even on your worst day, you know? And so for me personally, I always have faith in God, man. I always pray, you know, before shift, just, you know, hey, you know, put a hedge of protection around me, make sure, you know, that I can improve and impact somebody's life in a positive way that can alter anything negatively that they may have going or may be doing. Mm-hmm. And also outside of the job, man, I try to spend time with the family. You know, I try to spend time, you know, with the people that love me, my girl, my you know, spending vacations or taking a trip here and there, and just getting my mind off of the job. And I think that it's important to have that separation. There's so many people that I know that do this job and they're consumed. They're consumed. Mm-hmm. They're working. They're getting the OT, man. They're doing the off-duty gigs. They're always consumed with the job, but they don't have time for their social life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had an old head tell me one time, he was just like, he was telling another officer, he was just like, hey, man, don't work so hard that when your day is called, the only thing that you remember for is that you are a hard worker.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that people know you for, is that you work hard. That's the only attribute that you have. They don't know if you're cool. They don't know if you're kind. They don't know if you're considerate of any, you know, anybody else. They don't know if you're trustworthy. Like, they don't know any type of social skills that you may have or bring to the table. All they know is that you're a hard worker, man.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be remembered for something that is not only impactful, but you want to be remembered for, like, the totality of everything that you've done in your life to be something that's worth bragging about, you know? So,
of course,
I just try to balance it with that faith and just, like I said, taking my time off to do whatever it is, fishing, traveling, or spending time with the family. I think that's important just to decompress.
Yeah, most definitely, man. It's definitely healthy too in terms of a mental aspect. Cause if you, like you said, if you consume yourself with the job, man, I think that can lead you down such a dark path. You don't know who you truly are as a person, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it kind of relates to football, right? If you consume yourself with just being a football player or basketball player, just an athlete in general, and you don't know your hobbies such as reading or even now today with podcasting, if you don't know your hobbies, man, I think later on in life, you will start to feel a sense of darkness, a sense of depression because you don't know what else to do. So I definitely think that's you spending time with your family and not doing too much overtime and doing too much off-duty gigs is healthy for you, man. I definitely applaud that you know that. So when it comes to one of the most dangerous calls in law enforcement, I believe that's domestic violence. So, you know, as an officer, you never know what can happen when dealing with love and passion, because that's some of the strongest feelings ever, man. The unthinkable can really happen when you deal with those two factors right there. But how do you keep your composure when dealing with that issue?
Yeah. And to answer your question, to add on love and passion, also when people do consume alcoholic beverages in the midst of love and passion, because they act off of not only passion, not only off love, but they act off of not their own sound judgment.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, man, and for any other officer, man, when you do go into these heightened disturbances, domestic violence type calls, you really have to gain a true sense of appreciation for the victim, and you have to recognize the victim and the suspect. And even if you cannot recognize the victim and the suspect, simply talking. I think that this job builds your interpersonal skills, man. It allows you and gives you the ability to think, to ask questions at the flip of a dime. And when you see people who have been routinely involved in family violence, domestic violence type of issues, their tone of voice is a little bit off. You know, they're stuttering. Their eyes are kind of impulsated with, you know, redness. You can see the strain in their eyes. You know, you're looking for bruises. You're You're looking at their hand movements. You're looking at their feet. You're looking at the building or the room around you to see if anything was thrown around. But also keep in mind, DJ, and you know this, and you know a lot of people who are studious and what's going on and might know this. A lot of women who are in domestic violence incidents, they feel as if they have to hold something back.
Yes, definitely.
Because of love.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that passion.
Yep.
So they can be getting pounded. They can be getting their butt beat, but they're not going to say anything because they love their husband. They love their mm-hmm. boyfriend.
They want to protect them. Know,
yeah. Yeah. And they know as soon as their boyfriend finds out that either she's telling the truth or in some cases, if she talks to the police at all, as soon as he bonds out, he's coming right back. Mm-hmm. And then the same continuing cycle of violence is going to happen again.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for women, not to say that men aren't any type of victims towards domestic violence, because there are.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, the common form of domestic violence is towards women. Not to say men aren't involved in it at all.
Yeah, the majority.
Yeah, exactly. And so, mm-hmm. Just dealing with women and stuff, they're very afraid to say something. They're very afraid to open up. And it's just, it hurts sometimes. But like I said, it's all about how you talk to people, separating both parties, making sure that, when the woman, the female is giving her statement, or on the other side, flip side, if the male is giving him statements, you don't have them looking at each other. You don't have them talking to one another. You have them in separate rooms. You have one outside, you have one inside, just making sure that everybody's safe and sound, no weapons are involved, no weapons are in the area.
Yeah.
It's kind of, how can we settle this down and then make a sound judgment based off of, what's going on. And then you have those other instances where people just do stuff out of passion.
Yeah.
You'll get to the scene and they're like, hey, what happened? What's going on? I did this. That was me.
Mm-hmm.
I did that to that female. That was me. That was me. Go ahead, hook me up. Go ahead, hit me up. And that's that out of passion. Like they don't, or that individual doesn't care about any outcome.
Yeah.
It's just about getting back, And that is so detrimental, man, because when kids are at the household, man, and kids are crying for mama, and they're watching daddy beating on mama, and they're watching mama, come home late at night doing whatever she's doing. They think that not only is it okay, but they think like that's the only way that they'll make it out is if they have to follow that same path.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like, my dad so this, and my mom did this. And I saw mama do, she can't tell me what to do. Dad, pops can't tell me really what to do because he didn't do nothing. Yep. And there's that combativeness issue. And then when that kid gets to 12, 13, 14, 15 years of age, he thinks or she thinks that she can make sound judgments on their own.
Yeah.
And the parent is like, I can't deal with it anymore. And that's what we deal with in society nowadays.
Yep, it is.
So.
It becomes the kid's reality.
Yeah.
Like you said, it becomes their norm. When they grow up watching their mom get beat or grow up their dad selling drugs, like you said, that's their only way out. And that's normal to them. And it's hard to break. I want to get into how important is it, because I know it's very important to kind of comfort the victim, but how important is it to also not comfort, but really talk with the suspect in a domestic violence case?
Yeah, man. Speaking with the suspect can sometimes feel as if it's one ear and out the other.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with people who simply have, number one, who don't want to talk to police.
Yeah.
Don't care and just simply are like, hey, I can care less what you got to say. I plead the fifth, or I'm not saying anything, And then you have those other instances where you're speaking to the suspect and it's like they're in a daze.
Mm.
And when you simply talk to them about what's all happening and what's going on and the implications that it's going to have for their family to come, then they start to get in that remorse mode of I'm sorry, but I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to say sorry, but like I wish I could take this all back, or let me see my wife for one more time. Let me see my girl one more time. Let me give her a kiss. Let me do this. I tell them all the time, when police are called, that discretion is over for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can get there and you can say nothing happened. You can say this, you know, this was just all a mistake, but your discretion is gone when that 911 call is called to us, you know, to our dispatchers, and they dispatch it on us. So speaking with the suspects, man, I always try to give them that sense of realism. And if I can't speak to them towards their own life, I always tell them who's watching.
Yeah.
And if they do have kids, I was like, look at your kids, man. They're looking at you right now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't put them in the house because I want them to look at you right now. Because some people have to feel embarrassed in order to change.
Yes.
Definitely. You know, it's not necessarily about them doing wrong. It's the principle of them doing wrong and being embarrassed while they're doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, all right, I'm never going to do this again. I can get my kids taken away from me. Oh, I'm never going to do this again.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is going to jail for 3, 4, 5+ years. I'm never going to do this again. Mm-hmm. You know, or I'm going to jail for a long time. I'm done. So I think it's the reality setting in, instead of just, you know, placing the handcuffs on them. Always try to leave them with a message, like, if they're being cooperative, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because then you do have those subjects that, you know, are kind of all, you know, take you for a loop. But for the ones that are being cooperative, I always try to give them that message that they can be better. Even in spite of what they got going on right now, they can be better. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of puts things into perspective for them. They're just a regular person, just like you are. You know, I'm not here to treat you like an animal. You know, I'm not here to throw you in the back and slam the door in your face, not give you any AC in the back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to just treat you like a regular person. You done wrong. You're going to own up to your wrongdoing. You're going to see a judge. They're going to set whatever stipulation or statute of limitations that they follow towards your life.
Mm-hmm.
Move on from it. That's something that you have to learn from, man. So, yeah.
And so when you respond to that domestic violence call, are you, as an officer, are you on your toes because you never know what could happen? Like, describe to me how you are when you respond to that call.
Yeah, man. So we have, like, kind of levels to domestic violence, family violence type of calls, whether there's a firearm involved, whether the person is under the influence, whether it be any type of narcotic substances or alcohol, if children are involved, if it's an active disturbance, meaning that the person is actually physically still beating them up while the person is on the phone. It's always leveled. For me personally, man, and people have to understand that when we go to these calls and, you know, we get clearance to go lights and sirens, you know, our computer is continually updating. So we're driving and it can say subject is on the ground. She's still getting beat. The suspect is going to the room to pull out a knife, or, you know, the suspect is running away from the location. It's almost like football, man. When you go into a game and they let you walk the field, you got your headphones on and you're visualizing what you're going to do. You know, you're visualizing, you know, what the moves that you're going to make, the catches that you're going to make, the blocks that, you know, you're going to get. It's kind of similar towards the job that we do in law enforcement, man. Like, okay, if he runs out, you know, what am I going to do right here? Am I going to, you know, call Eagle up? Am I going to, you know, go ahead and I got one running over the radio and take off? Am I going to consult that victim? Am I going to make sure no suspects are inside of the house? That's what I'm thinking, man. I'm thinking about all of the things that are outside of the intangibles of what I have to do, you know? Yeah. And I think that, yes, to answer your question, bro, I am on my toes, you know? And, you know, your heart rate is a little elevated, you know, because you don't know what's going on, man.
Exactly.
I'm going off the notes on my key card. You know, I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's false. I don't know if it's, you know, something drastically has happened and it's just coming out, you know, as a minor thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's me, man. I'm always thinking about, you know, what else can I do? How can I, you know, do this? Or what if I'm playing the what if game?
Yeah.
You know, always expect the unexpected in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I always try to prepare myself for. I don't ever take any call lightly. I don't ever take, you know, going to any type of situation like an easy call. You know that 911 hang up could be somebody simply having, you know, a heart attack undergoing cardiac arrest. Mm-hmm. And then you roll up and you're like, oh shoot, like I should have taken this more seriously than before.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. So, but yeah, man. So yeah, to answer your question, yeah.
And so as you're doing patrol, right, has that, the unexpected, the what ifs, has that made you doubt your career field?
No, man. To be honest with you, as I stated in the beginning, and this is for anybody going into law enforcement or anybody trying to pursue a career in the criminal justice field, you got to have that same mindset as far as your purpose. When you first start, that purpose has to be solidified.
Yeah.
To the point to where when you go into stuff and further along you get in that job, that purpose is still at the forefront. Because if you do this job with no purpose, then you don't have anything at all, man.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have purpose behind what you do. You have to have that same goal. If my goal is to join the department and make a change for my community and you know, help out people who are, you know, misguided, misunderstood, and don't have a voice or simply need that outlook on life itself through somebody that looks like them in a uniform, mm-hmm. then that has to be my forefront goal, moving up. Because if I lose that, if I lose who I am, if I lose my identity, then it's like I'm doing it for me and I don't do this for me. Okay. You know what I'm saying? I'm not a law enforcement officer for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't do this for the paycheck, you know, DJ. And you know, like all the stuff that we do, you know, like it's tough.
Yeah.
But I don't do this for the paycheck. I do this for the people who, you know, who are sick and shut in, the ones who, you know, simply don't have any outlook on law enforcement, but they come to me. You know, hey KB, you know, what happens if this, or hey KB, you know, I'm hemmed up on this, or you know, hey, I'm, you know, I need your advice on a certain situation. You know, for some people, I'm their only outlook on that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm the only law enforcement officer in my family of any type of capacity. Yeah. You know, so it's an avenue of a resource for other people. But then also too, man, it's just like you just always have to have that purpose up front that continually mm-hmm. keeps you going. So when you have that bad day, you're like, all right, I still got my purpose, man. I know it's tough right now. I know it's strenuous right now. I know an event just happened right now, but I'm still gonna keep my faith, and I'm still gonna be like, man, you know, I'm doing this for a reason, and it's not for me.
Yeah,
it's for other people to see.
So, mm-hmm. It's a bigger picture.
Yeah, big fact.
It's a much bigger picture. So let's get into something that has been going on. Actually, it's been going on for a while, but it's kind of really gone on to the forefront over these past couple of years, and that's defund the police, right?
Yeah.
So I want to get your opinion on defund the police, but do you really think that defunding the police will solve the issues that's happening within our community?
Personally, man, I don't, man. I don't. If you speak to a lot of, and in which I do, you speak to a lot of community leaders, people who have who got rep in the hood or any type of urban area or underdeveloped socioeconomic area that have served time, they'll tell you the benefits and the negative effects of not having police. Mm-hmm. I do feel as if police should be more inclined to the community in which they're serving.
Serving. Mm-hmm.
Meaning they should have a better understanding. If I'm in, you know, South Central LA, I need to know how it operates. You know, not be a cat from Hollywood, not be a cat from, you know, Chino Hills or something like that, coming down thinking I can tell these boys what to do. You mm-hmm. you can't do that, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that the relationships are built off of commonalities and, you know, the whole mantra of defund the police and all this other stuff. You talk to them, man, they're going to tell you, like, we need police, especially in our community, bro. Especially mm-hmm. in our community.
Yeah.
You know, it'll cripple us down, man. You know, and I feel as if, you know, I hear some say all the time, whether it be on social media and stuff like that, when I read, you know, police posts or whatever, you know, who do you guys call when, you know, something goes on? You call police, you call 911. Well, that yes, but in the same sense, though, my thing is, we need, if we don't have police, total chaos is going to go out, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, you know, stuff will be happening at random, stuff will be happening at will. And then you have, you know, gang rivals, you know, ganging up on each other, and you can't solve anything with chaos going on. You know, so I think that if people could just see that there are actually officers who are trying to make a difference, who are trying to step out and be that, you know, that officer that everybody wants to see. Yeah, we need more black officers. If you defund, it's like you're hurting everybody. Yeah. You're hurting the good ones. You know, you're hurting the bad ones. And, you know, I bust my butt just like every other officer out here. And, you know, I may have that same purpose. And there might be another person out there that's just like, hey, I don't care if you're a black officer. I don't care if you're a white officer. I just want to, you know, take money away from you. And it's just like, you know, DJ, there's some stuff, you know, that I've done. And I don't try to brag on it, but there's some stuff that I've done in these previous years for kids in the neighborhood, or setting up, you know, back to school drives, you know, and doing stuff out of my own pocket just for the benefit of the people in the community. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more personal when you actually care and you give.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not in the business to receive, man. So, you know, there's kids that have come up to me. There's moms that have called me or have called my substation and say, hey, can I speak to Officer Bill? You know, he saved my child. You know, he's done this for me. Or, you know, having parents that literally send you updates on their child because, you know, you gave them a sticker, or you talk to them, or you let them play with your lights, and you see them during Christmas time, and we have a Blue Santa program down here in San Antonio, and mm-hmm. you give them gifts, they remember that stuff, man. And so it's just all of that going into, you know, if you want to put into a crystal ball, man, it's just like, that's, to me personally, I don't think that that's the correct way to go. However, I do feel as if, like I stated earlier, having officers who understand the community,
yes,
who know the community, that's important. That's what we need to attack. You know, if an officer and people can say, you know, well, he'll learn the area, he'll learn. If for somebody who's lived in an area for 26 years, an officer who's just moved over to that district trying to serve and protect that community is not going to learn in 1 year. Okay. It's not going to learn in his whole career. Mm-hmm. You can't tell a 26-year-old man, a 27, 30, if he's an OG status up in the 50s, how to act in his own community if you've only served there a year and you don't know what they have to go through. And mm-hmm. you don't respect, you know, what they have to go through, man. And I think that that's important, man. You got to respect boundaries. You have to.
You do.
And I'm not saying you got to go along with what they got going on or something, but you have to realize that, you know, other people got it a little bit differently than you.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to say, okay, I got you, man. You know, like I'm respecting you. It's all mutual respect. What you got going on, man. Like it's all about how you can talk, and you can be, you don't even have to be from the community sometimes to really understand, but it's just having that open ear.
Yeah.
To, you know, community problems, you know, community intervention. And I think that, you know, if you know, officers can go in and do more community intervention, then that would be, instead of being forced to,
that would solve a lot of issues, man. That would solve a lot of issues.
Yeah. So, but yeah, man.
So like you said, like the police and community relationship is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other ways that, you know, we can attack the issues that's happening within our community, such as gang violence, poverty, lack of educational funding, homelessness? What are some other ways that we can attack that without having to take from the police?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think that it has a lot to do, and excuse me, scratch my eye, it has a lot to do with you know, getting with, you know, your community leaders along with city council members, man, because city council, they have that district council has a direct insight to the mayor, has a direct insight to city board members. And I believe that if you can improve, whether it be infrastructure, you know, if you see a project that's been there since the 50s and you see people complaining about the streets, you see people complaining about the lack of adequate water, adequate, you know, supermarkets, you can push that narrative forward and say, hey, you know, what can we do for this group right here? And I'm talking about socioeconomic status levels. What can we do for this group right here that can improve their livelihood? What if we build, you know, low cost living, or it doesn't even have to be low cost living, but I'm just saying in general, but what if we can build another suitable way of life here and they can move here? Because sometimes people are born into situations that it's hard to get out of.
Hard.
Exactly. And that's what people have to get to the realization of, man, you know? And so if you, you know, like I said, going with city council and whatnot, but also too, man, when we talk about nutrition and we talk about, you know, staying in shape, and you talk about the lack of a whole foods, the lack of, you know, healthy,
yes, sir,
ways of life or gyms, man. You go to any type of underdeveloped or urban community, look at the amount of gyms in the area, man. Like, look at the amount of healthy food habits. You know, I'm not talking about Burger King, churches, Popeyes, you know, we cater to, man. We could just drive up. You know, we're used to it because that's all we know, you know? And so when you develop, you know, not only when poor infrastructure is developed with poor eating habits, and when you look at, like I said, the school systems, which are already covered, all of it kind of flows in order. And I broke this down to some people too. And when we talk about, you know, kids growing up and resorting to gang and gun violence or anything like that, I'm going to just pose something to you, DJ. Mm-hmm. You go to any urban community per capita, man, how many pawn shops you going to find, bro? You're going to find at least, I'm thinking like 8 to 9, maybe 10 in some areas. Now, out of them same areas, man, how many places can you go get a holster for that weapon? You know, it's maybe what, only 2 to 3, maybe 4?
Not many at all.
Exactly. And now you break that down, where can you actually go get trained to use that weapon? You know? So it's like me personally, the way I think of it as, a lot of our youth in the Black community, I can speak for the Black community because, you know, we're here. A lot of us that do not have the necessities of life, as I stated earlier, poor infrastructure, poor eating habits, don't have access to, you know, physical recreation activities. They'll resort to, you know, buying a gun, which is easily accessible. However, they have no studious capacity on how to use that gun or how to, you know, have it on their hip at all times in a holster. You know, they don't know, you know, so it's easier to have that easeable access to a weapon rather than easeable access to health and fitness, nutrition, education, because it's not that isn't glamorous because it isn't pushed. So if it isn't pushed, they're going to resort to something that their friends are doing.
Yep, that's absolutely right, man. And one thing in our community, right, there's so many avenues where you can take a wrong turn. And like you said, it's not enough gyms. It's not enough Whole Foods. It's not enough Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
But it's a whole lot of McDonald's, Popeyes, churches, liquor stores. And so I think in order for us to break that cycle, because we're a product of our own environment. And in order for us to get away from that environment, we need the help from government officials, mayors, to actually fix our community. So I think that point is so huge to make, you know, for everybody that's watching and listening, man. We definitely need help in improving our environment.
Yeah. And so and to add on to what you were saying, man, I want to clarify for some people, because I had, you know, a couple friends outside of the job really not understanding. This isn't to say I want you to feel sorry for me, so I want you to give me something. No, that's not what I'm proposing. That's not what I'm proposing at all. What I'm saying is that some people are born into situations. Some people are born into environments where the access to the same type of resources that you may have in another area just isn't there.
Yeah.
So what they've grown up thinking is right is wrong in your eyes because you've been taught the correct way. So some people don't know the correct way. Mm-hmm. And it's not a, you know, it's not to say, you know, hey, you know, they, oh man, I feel bad for you and whatnot. No, it's not to say that. What we're trying to do is improve our own communities. How can we get better? How can we teach each other? How can we correct people to say, hey, you know, whether it be a kid, whether it be an adult, saying you can be better than what you're around right now. You can do better. You can see better. You can envision. I see you as a lawyer, as a doctor, as a spokesperson, as somebody that's in a, you know, in a good space, a good headspace to make something happen, man.
And so what I want to get into, right, do you believe in this country we can find a way to pour in that money to give us access to Whole Foods, more gyms within our community? Do you think we can actually get the funding to actually do those things? Because right now we find other ways to pour in money to other countries or other avenues in this country that doesn't even truly matter, right? And I think these politicians, man, they do a hell of a job of saying something, but never, you know, basically keeping their word. So do you think we can actually find that funding to basically improve the life of the minority community?
That's a real, real good point. You know, me personally, man, I think it's an uphill battle. It's an uphill process. You may have, and I say you as far as the country, our country may have the resources to help out a few communities. However, the totality of all the communities involved, man, there's always going to be people who need assistance, people who need help, people who simply don't have what other people have, the have versus the have nots. When you look at the history of this country, and when you look at the stuff that minorities had to endure, throughout the United States, and you look at the United States now, a lot has changed, yes, but also too, you see the poor and the rich just spreading out even more than what they are, and that middle class just staying right there in the middle. So it's literally like you got the middle class stagnant, you got the poor getting poor, you got the rich getting richer. And so I think that as a country, man, I think that it'll be tough, but it's an everyday process. It's an uphill battle. We can sit here and say, yeah, we'll give, you know, $300 million to urban communities. But also, too, DJ, keep in mind, who are you really giving it to? I mean, you can give, you know, let's say if you give $20 million to LA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is that going to go towards, then you got to split it up. Is it going to go towards, you know, District 6, District 7, District, you know, District 8 or whatever districts are aligned there? And then you got to break it down. Which neighborhood is it going to go to?
Mm-hmm.
And so you got people fighting over money, you know. And when you got people fighting over money and you got the U.S. giving money, that just adds to the inflation that's already going on right now, man.
Yes, indeed.
And it's just like, I want to say yes for the whole United States, you know, for every city, every municipality in the country. Yeah, we can do it, but it's an uphill battle. Is it being done right now? Yes. Is it been done enough? No,
mm-mm.
It hasn't, you know. And so I just think that it's just an uphill battle. I don't think that we'll fully get to the point to where we're like, hey, you know, everybody's taken care of. We're good. Let's keep it going. Because of the history, man, you have to understand our country's history in order to fully understand, you know, how can we improve, you know, society today.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And so I want to end it off with this question right here. I know we kind of harped on it earlier, but, in order for the police and the community be to be in lockstep with each other, what are some ways that we can make that happen?
Yeah. I think one of the main ways, and I always bring it up because I'm kind of loving the idea of it, but introducing law enforcement, community relations classes within the classroom and school. Mm. Outside of social media, man, school is the most impactful place for a child to be. They learn from their teachers. They learn from their friends. They learn from, you know, everybody that's up there because heck, they're up there from K through 12th grade, you know? So I think that if we can get into the school systems, which you have units that, you know, are, you know, in the school systems, may, you know, school one school police. May have an officer, yeah, school police mm-hmm. officer. But I'm talking about actually getting into it, you know, actually setting up, yeah, actually setting up a classroom, a class mm-hmm. that shows and tells you, gives people, it puts them in their shoes, whether they're putting on, you know, some drunk goggles and trying to figure out stuff that's going on, or putting them in situations where they have to critically think, use their mind, putting them in situations where they have to save somebody or they have to make a decision at the split of a dime, whether it's good, whether it's bad, or whether they just have to go off their own sound judgment. And then having people explain what they've just done.
Yeah.
Because see, right now, I think that what it is you, and you have it on both sides. It's the understanding, man. And so I think to answer your question outright, bro, because I know you're in on time, to answer your question outright, I think the school system is very important. Getting more acclimated in the school systems and giving the students real-life world settings, not just showing mm-hmm. videos, not just showing PowerPoints, not just there to talk and to do, but what to say on a traffic stop, how to act on a traffic stop, you know, how to breathe. And a lot of people act, you just said it earlier, off of passion. A lot of people say stuff off of emotion. So that mm-hmm. passion, that emotion, that aggression is coming out instead of taking a deep breath and saying, hey, mm-hmm. okay, what, and just talking. Because that breath can kind of like clear your mind from cussing at an officer or saying something crazy or, you know, just doing something stupid, where you can just be like, because I tell them all the time, I want you to go home. It's not if you're right or wrong. I want you to go home, man.
Absolutely.
You know, it's important for you guys, man. So the school system's number one. I think also too, more emphasis on, you know, kids, whether it be, a march, whether it's Martin Luther King March, whether it's any type of community initiative where the community is up front. So the police are there, of course, but they're more involved, you know, walking alongside people, not kids, walking alongside people and saying, I'm human just like you. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand what you're going through. We're in this together. You know, it's not a side. It's not a police side and a negative community side. It's not a community side. And I'm against police. This is how can we do this together? Because when I take this gun in off my hip and I take the badge and I set it down, I'm a regular person. You know, I'm
just like you.
Mm-hmm. You're just like you. And so I think that, you know, law enforcement officers get involved, whether it be Martin Luther King marches or anything where their expectancy isn't voluntarily, like, you know, you're pushing for them to be with you, you know, because you see officers at MLK marches, but what are they doing? They're just, you know, a lot of them are just, you know, just sitting there just to, you know, make sure nothing pops off,
interacting.
No fights occur. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But actually walking, talking with people, eating some barbecue, mm-hmm. dancing with the people.
Yes.
Like that's, it's the unexpectancy. It's the stuff that makes you be like, I ain't never seen that before. That mm-hmm. kind of gets you to appreciate. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely, man. So yeah. So community intervention, schools. I think that in itself kind of covers everything, man. In my mind that I can possibly think of right now.
I love the school aspect, right? Because like you said, we have school police, but they're there to react to what could happen and not actually teaching kids how to interact with police. And so I love that school aspect, but do you think in today's society with social media and with everything happening with law enforcement in the community, such as, you know, a wrong shooting or something like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that school classroom stuff would be accepting within our community?
It's a yes and it's a no, man. But you got to keep in mind though, DJ, this is in any job that you do. You're going to have people that hate you. You're going to have people that dislike you. You're going to have people that don't even agree what you got going on, but you still got to press forward, man. And especially when it comes to kids, me personally, I haven't received like a lot of negative drawback, you know, towards kids because I don't go in there with the, I'm Officer Bell, you know, mindset. You know, I tell them all the time, hey man, you know, y'all can call me Bell. Y'all can call me KB. You know, I got Bell on my shirt. But y'all could just call me, hey, officer, you know, like it doesn't matter to me. Right now, I don't go by a title, man. You know, I'm here to help educate you guys, help you guys learn. That's the most important thing. I don't want you scared to open up to me because you don't know how to approach me. That's the thing. You know, I don't want you feeling as if you can't speak to me because of what you see on social media and is not happening in our neighborhood. But you see it on social media and you take it for granted that every officer is doing that. Every officer is out to get me, my family. I don't care. I'm not speaking. But I think that if you can find out which kid has the most trouble and you speak to them on a level of understanding, I promise you. I've done it. I promise you, man. It's eye-opening, man. It's eye-opening. And they might... You got to understand, some kids might feel abrasive when you up there at the schools and you speaking to the students and you putting them on blast and you embarrassing them. Mm-hmm. They might look at it as, man, this officer. But I guarantee you, when they go home, they're going to be like, hey, man. Dang. Like, they'll start to realize the sense of appreciation, you know, because anybody can get up there and speak. Anybody can sit up there and, you know, give a presentation or make a PowerPoint. But it's the sincerity of checking on a student, making sure that, you know, they're okay, that they have what they need, not only in school, but in life, man.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how you truly impact somebody.
I think it's so important, right, to not let the actions of a few officers to paint a picture of, you know, law enforcement as a whole. And I think it's kind of like this, right? Back in the days, or even now today, you got black people committing crimes, right? And then these white people or whatever, they think that, oh, that's black people as a whole community. And so I think it's so huge to get that in people's minds that we cannot let the actions of some be just paint a whole picture of the whole thing. I think that's so important for people to know that.
And stop stereotyping every group to have some sort of crime in itself. Yes. You know, all you know, white people may do this, or all Hispanic people may do this, or all black people are all Asian. And it's just when you get that and it happens, that negative counterpart sometimes hits me sometimes when I come up with people and they're like, oh, you speak a certain way, or they look at you a little bit differently because you're not, you know, the person what that they see. Oh yeah, exactly. If that makes sense, man. And it's like, it shouldn't have to come to the point to where I have to appropriate myself to correct your wrong misunderstanding of who we are as people and as a culture, man. Mm-hmm. Like that's something on you that you have to correct personally. But yeah, exactly. I agree.
Exactly, man. And so that's how we're gonna wrap it off, man. Hey, thank you guys for tuning in to the Views and Voices podcast. I'm your host, DeJuan Thompson. Thank you.